that we've really achieved something that doesn't see the causal structure. But I want to start all of this by sort of giving you some background about where I think all of this is going. So this is so the first part of the talk is sort of more my view than Matt's view, but it's a little bit of background on how I'm thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics and where this work ties into it. So for many years now, I've been arguing that we should think of quantum states as like states of knowledge rather than states of reality. And the main argument comes from the following fact, which is that if you take a classical statistical theory, so this is the theory of how probability distributions over a classical state space evolve as the classical states evolve, how those probability distributions update when you do measurements, things like that. And then you add one extra foundational postulate, which is that there's some restriction on the kinds of statistical distributions that you can prepare, you get a large part of quantum theory, in the sense that you reproduce the same operational predictions as that large part of quantum theory. So I mean, there's a set of preparations and measurements and transformations in quantum theory which you reproduce the operational predictions exactly for the theory you've defined. And then when you look in that theory, which remember, you start from just a classical theory and you're just imposing a limitation on how much you know. When you look at that theory and say, well, what plays the role of a quantum state? Because we're reproducing quantum mechanics. The answer is that two non-orthogonal quantum states, these two here, correspond in that theory to two probability distributions over the classical phase space, which have some overlap. So rather than corresponding to two points in the phase space, in which case we could validly say that, you know, those guys corresponded to states of reality in the classical theory, they correspond to these probability distributions. And furthermore, if I look at a particular state of reality in the classical theory, so a particular point in this phase space, it's consistent with multiple different distributions. So it means that in this picture, you can change the quantum state without changing reality at all. You're just changing your knowledge from this to this. And so that's the sense in which, in these approaches, the quantum state is merely a state of knowledge rather than a state of reality.
Rob, sorry, can you please repeat the definition of reality in the model, so on the right-hand side of the picture?
So this is like a classical phase space, a position and momentum. And if you said, what's a state of reality, it would be complete specifications of all the properties of the system. So that would be a point in the phase space. So every point in the phase space would be a state of reality or an ontic state. And probability distributions over that state space don't describe the particular parameters in this distribution, don't describe any aspect of reality. They describe an agent's relation to reality, what the agent knows about that reality. Okay, so I want to do a quick review of an example of this kind of theory, and this is going to come up later in the talk for comparison. So we need to start with a classical theory, so I'm going to start with particle mechanics, and we need to add this foundational principle that limits how much information you can have about the classical state. So there are various ways of doing that, and I'm going to just consider a very simple one. So it's not going to get as much of quantum mechanics as I can get, but it's a very simple one that I can describe easily. I'll call it the principle of classical complementarity. An observer can only jointly know a set of variables if they commute relative to the Poisson bracket. So this is just a constraint on when certain classical variables can be jointly known. So if I use curly brackets to denote Poisson bracket, if I have two functions f and g over the phase space, then they commute relative to the if they commute relative to the Poisson bracket, then you can jointly know them. So for example, if I have two systems, A and B, and I talk about the position of the first of system A and the position of system B, I calculate the Poisson bracket, it's zero. That's a pair of variables I can jointly know. So there's no problem knowing the positions of the two systems. Similarly, with knowing the position of the first system and the momentum of the second. Of course, if I said, what about the position of the first system, QA, and PA, the momentum of the first system, well, they wouldn't commute relative to the Poisson bracket. So according to theory, you couldn't jointly know those two variables. Other variables you could jointly know include things that are sort of joint properties of the two systems. So for example, the difference in the positions of the two systems and the sum of their momenta also commute relative to the Poisson bracket. So that's a pair of things you could know simultaneously. So what does that mean? Well, the kinds of preparation procedures that you're allowed in this sort of model includes probability distributions over the phase space that are arbitrarily narrow in position, but completely uniform in momentum. That corresponds to just knowing the position and not knowing anything about the momentum. And that corresponds to a position eigenstate in quantum theory. Or you could know everything about the momentum, nothing about the position. That's like a momentum eigenstate. You could rotate those guys in the phase space, so have knowledge of any quadrature. And for this example here, if you know the difference in positions and the sum of the momenta, that corresponds to a probability distribution on the full phase space of the two systems, which looks like this. There's four directions in this phase space. It's a delta function along the axis corresponding to the difference in position, and the axis corresponding to the sum of the momenta, and it's uniform over the other two axes. And that's the analog within this model of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen state, where position is perfectly correlated and momenta are perfectly anticorrelated. So here there are states of knowledge. And then you can just sort of work out all the other features of this theory that follow from that foundational postulate. So you can say, what are the valid transformations on phase spaces? So for single system, I'm allowed rotations in the phase space. I'm allowed phase space displacements. If you ask what are the valid measurements, you'll find that, you know, measuring position is fine, measuring momentum is fine, but you can't measure both at the same time. That would violate the postulate. And what you can prove is that if you take particle mechanics, statistical particle mechanics, which is sometimes called Liouville mechanics, with this restriction, you get that it's precisely equivalent to a sub-theory of quantum mechanics, which I call quadrature quantum mechanics. So it's just the eigenstates of linear combinations of position momentum observables, the measurements of those sorts of observables, the transformations that keep you within that set of states. Yes?
There seems to be nothing quantitative about your condition on joint knowability.
That's right.
Unlike Prime aberration.
Right.
So you could know the position precisely and momentum almost precisely, for instance.
Yeah.
But that wasn't in your list of...
So there's a more general approach where my starting postulate is it's basically a classical version of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where you're not allowed to know position and momentum to better than h-bar, effectively. And then you get a larger set of quantum theory. You actually get all of Gaussian quantum mechanics, where you're also allowed these Gaussian quantum states, which include coherent states. Whereas here, quadrature quantum mechanics is only the infinitely squeezed coherent states. So this is sort of a poorer theory than you can ultimately derive from this approach, but it's a little bit easier to explain how it works. So that's all I'm trying to do here, sort of give a flavor for how these sorts of theories work. And I'm only going to need this apparatus.
Maybe you should go on, but it seems like it should be a richer theory because it allows an awful lot of space, which a more constrained one wouldn't.
Sorry, which is a richer theory?
This one seems like a richer theory. It seems like it would allow more preparation as well.
No, because if I allow, for example, any Gaussian that satisfies the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, then I can make it very narrow in position and spread it out in momentum. And in the limit, it will be one of those distributions that I showed on the previous slide. So these will be special cases of the Gaussian states, but not vice versa. I can't represent an arbitrary Gaussian state like this.
But from the condition you've given here, why can't you represent a Gaussian state, for instance?
Because I'm only allowed to... know a variable perfectly or not at all according to this condition.
Oh, perfectly or not at all.
Yeah, I can, when I say, know a set of variables, I mean know their value precisely. We could talk about the other theories that have all the Gaussian states in them. But this is all I'm going to need for today. So now I want to talk about a couple of quantum phenomena and how they arise in this sort of approach. So I'm going to look at the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect. And so I'm going to denote to the two systems, A and B, in this way. So they're prepared and in an entangled state. And so I'm just going to use this dotted line here to mean that there's no causal connection between A and B. So there's no direct cause from one to the other, but they may be correlated because of some common cause. Suppose you prepare the following valid state of knowledge for this pair of systems, which correspond to knowing the difference of their positions and the sum of their momenta. So just this distribution here corresponds to the EPR state. What do you know about system B initially? You know nothing, because if I take the marginal over the B space, I just get a uniform distribution over the fixed space. So you know nothing about the local system. But now if you come along and you measure the position of system A, which you're allowed to do, and you find some value, then because you knew that the positions of the two systems are perfectly correlated, you can infer what the position of the second system must be. And so you update from this uniform distribution to one where you know the position and you know nothing about the momentum. If, on the other hand, you'd measure the momentum of the first system and you found some outcome, then by virtue of knowing that these two systems have perfectly anti-correlated momenta, you can infer what the momentum of the other system is. And so you update your knowledge from this uniform distribution to knowing precisely what the momentum is and knowing nothing about the position. And so in this approach, what happens in the EPR effect is that there's some state of reality on the distant system all along. It occupies some point in phase space. And nothing about that state of reality changes as you choose which of the two measurements to do over here. It's merely your knowledge of that reality that's updated in one of two different ways, depending on whether you choose to resolve your uncertainty about position or to resolve your uncertainty about momentum. So it resolves the EPR paradox in the way that Einstein would have liked, which is that you say that the quantum state is not a complete description of reality. The complete description of reality doesn't change at all. You just update your knowledge about it in different ways. OK, footnote, this doesn't work for, I haven't said it works for all measurements and states, but for the EPR measurements and states, that model works. Now let's consider a second case where we have a direct measurement on a system. So rather than learning about a faraway system by measuring something that's correlated with it, I do a direct measurement on it. So now, again, I have to introduce a bit of notation here. When I draw a diagram with arrows in it, I mean that these things are causally connected. So B is a cause of B prime. And in particular, it could be that, so in this case, B prime is actually the same system as B, just considered at a later time. So that's a way in which those things can be causally connected. So the idea here is that I have a system B. I do a measurement. So Q represents the outcome of that measurement. So that's obviously causally influenced by B. And then the system is left over after the measurement's over, and I call it B prime. All right, so what you might expect if, for example, you originally know what the momentum of B is, and then you go and you measure its position and find some value, you might expect that you should just update your knowledge to a delta distribution over the whole phase space, because you knew its momentum, you've learned its position, so now you know everything. But that, of course, would violate that postulate I started with. You know, here you would know too much about position momentum. So this kind of update is not possible. So the lesson you draw from that is that measurement must work differently in this theory. It must be that if I do a measurement of position, which is reproducible, so if I did it again, I would get the same result, then the final distribution must be this one, where the position is known to be the value that I found, but I know nothing about the momentum. So that's how my state of knowledge would have to update under a measurement. It would have to be that this measurement of position randomizes the momentum, so that even though I knew it before the measurement, after the measurement's over, I have no idea what the momentum is. So that's what the theory says has to happen to preserve the postulate. But you can do better than that. You can explain why that happens by actually analyzing the measurement itself and say, well, we're just going to introduce a probe system, which I'll call A, and the way we're going to model the measurements is to say that B interacts with the probe system, and then measurement is made on the probe system. And that's how you infer what the position of B was. So this little diagram just means that B and A are interacting. This is what they are early and late. So what kind of interaction will work well? Well, just take a von Neumann coupling. Right, so this is the Hamiltonian that interacts these guys. This is the position of particle B, the momentum of particle A. And so what it means is that because momentum is the generator of translations, the system A will be translated by an amount that's proportional to the original position of B under this interaction. And so what's going to happen is that the final position of A is going to be whatever its initial position was, pl- plus something that's proportional to the initial position of B. And so if you read out what the final position of A is and you knew its initial position, you can infer the position of B. And that's how it's a measurement of the position of B. So if you want to do that, then you'd better start off knowing what the position of system A is. So you'd better be in this kind of state of knowledge. Because if you didn't know what the position of A was and you measured its final position, you wouldn't be able to infer the position of B. So for this to be a good measurement, you have to start with a state of knowing the position of A. But now, here's the key, that there's an action-reaction principle in classical mechanics, which says that if this is going to be, you know, if these are going to evolve according to Hamiltonian dynamics, then not only does the probe measure the position of the system measures the momentum of the probe. Because this interaction is symmetric. Q is the generator of shifts in momentum, and P will be shifted by an amount proportional to the original momentum of A. That's what this part here says. And so, the final momentum of B is going to be related to the initial momentum of B by some shift that depends on the initial momentum of A. But you don't know what the initial momentum of A is. Therefore, you don't know how much it's been shifted. So at the end of the day, it's been shifted by some amount, any amount, because this could have had any momentum. You don't know what it is. And so your final knowledge is this. You know its position. You know nothing about its momentum. So in this approach, when you update your knowledge as a result of a direct measurement, it's not purely Bayesian conditioning. It's really two things. There's two steps to the process. So for example, if you did the measurement and you don't record the outcome, so you only know that the measurement has been done, but you don't know what outcome occurred, well, then you know that because of the physics of the measurement device and because of your initial state of knowledge of the probe, the system has to have been shifted in momentum by some unknown amount. And if you didn't know anything about its position originally, then at the end, you know nothing about it. It's been shifted by some unknown amount, and it had some initial position, but you don't know either. And then once you learn the outcome of the measurement, well, then you can update from that uniform distribution to knowing that it's at a particular position.
You're basically introducing a von Neumann chain here.
That's right, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, so that may be okay if you're von Neumann, but from the point of view of your philosophy here,
yes.
I was wondering quite how that works, because...
Well, what I'm saying is, suppose that classical mechanics holds...
I mean, it's got to stop somewhere, is
well,
what I mean.
It's just a consistency check. So I'm saying, suppose classical mechanics holds for all systems in the universe, and furthermore, suppose that the epistemic restriction holds for all systems on the universe. So not only can I not know the position momentum of the system itself, I can't know it for the probe either. And if I want to model the measurement on the probe by another system, I can't know it for there. And you find
the
that you get consistency.
The other system being you, I guess.
Sorry?
The other system being you, I guess. I mean, it's just I'm slightly bothered here. Because it's not really a prism. I was just wondering.
Yeah.
I suppose you could just say you don't know everything about yourself. I mean, that's what it... Is that what you have to say?
You could take the argument to the final measurement is my observing it. Do I know everything about my own initial position and momentum? Unlikely. But maybe you could try to do something even stronger and say that there's a sense in which you couldn't possibly know everything about yourself. And you could try to justify the restriction by some limitations on self-reference. But all I want to do is say, no matter, let's say you
there's
just...
something about how your state would have to change
yep.
as a result. You were trying to explain why the state of the B has to change as a result of the measurement
yep.
by introducing the probe.
Yep.
So when you get to the end of the chain, which is you or whatever, the state of that has to change, but you don't have an explanation of that because you'd need to introduce yet another probe, if you see what I mean.
I can keep introducing more and more probes. There's no problem with that. And
well, doesn't the chain have to end? I mean, are you happy with the chain just going on forever?
I guess I am. Maybe we should discuss it later. I'm not sure exactly what you're uncomfortable with. The minimal things we can say is I could derive this disturbance to momentum just by saying, look, it has to happen for the principle to be upheld. But then it's comforting to see that I can also derive it by just saying, well, the uncertainty principle has to hold for the probes as well, and they undergo Hamiltonian dynamics, and it's all consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the idea that this collapse rule in this theory breaks down into two parts. One is just propagating your beliefs about B to beliefs about B prime, and there's an unknown disturbance to momentum, and then that's followed by a Bayesian conditioning where you learn the outcome of the measurement and you resolve to knowing a particular position. Okay, so the story, which I've said many times, is that if you take these kinds of theories and you take your favorite set of quantum phenomena, which you think are hard to explain classically, and you ask how many of them fall on the side of being explainable in these kinds of restricted statistical theories, the answer is a long list. But there are some outliers, such as Bell inequality violations, contextuality, computational speedup, and quantum theory if it exists, and some others. And so these sorts of approaches don't get us all of quantum theory. What I think is right about them is the idea that in the correct interpretation of quantum theory, which in my view we have yet to find, the quantum state will be a state of knowledge. And so the question is, how do we think of it as a state of knowledge? What's it knowledge about? How can we do justice to the rest of the phenomena in this list? It's not going to be a local non-contextual hidden variable model, and in fact, it's not going to be a hidden variable model at all. I'm hoping that there's some sort of reality, and quantum states will be knowledge of that reality. So the rest of the talk is really about the attempts to kind of see what that theory looks like by not really solving the problem, but saying, well, let's just try to formulate quantum theory as a theory of Bayesian inference, a theory of how we update our knowledge, without answering the question of what is knowledge about. That's the idea. Okay, so let's get into it. So here's the key analogy. Quantum systems, which I'll label by letters near the beginning of the alphabet, are going to be analogous to particular kinds of classical variables, like R, which correspond to the phase-space coordinates of a canonical system. So R is actually a pair of variables, for example, Q and P, or it's all the positions and momentum of a set of systems. And probability distributions over that kind of variable are going to be analogous to operators on the Hilbert space of A, in particular positive operators in certain cases. And now note the difference between P of R, this is a function over variable R, and P of capital R equal to little r, which is the probability of some particular event. That's not a function, that's just a number. So this is the probability that's assigned to this particular event, and that's the thing for which I'm not claiming any particular analog at the moment. I'm not saying what the analog of the events are in the classical case over here on the quantum side. I'm just going to say that these sorts of objects are the analogs of probability distributions over classical variables. The analog of the normalization condition to these probability distributions is just the trace condition on quantum states. So people are probably familiar with this sort of analogy. It's sort of, especially in quantum information theory, it's sort of obvious that there's this nice analogy between probability distributions and quantum states. And in particular, if I look at a joint distribution over two variables, the natural analog is a joint quantum state on two systems. And if you look at marginalization, where you find the distribution over S given the joint by summing over R, well, that's analogous to the partial trace. And so, in this sort of approach, the partial trace doesn't correspond to anything you do in the lab. It corresponds to something you do in your head. You decide to ignore system A and just focus on system B. And so this is just a mental operation from your degrees of belief about A and B to your degrees of belief about B alone. Okay. Now, if you look at the theory of Bayesian inference, you'll find that there are three pillars. Belief propagation, where you start with your degrees of belief about a variable R, your degrees of belief about S given R, and you calculate what your degrees of belief about S should be. This formula. So just sum over R, P of S given R times P of R. There's also Bayes' theorem, which allows you to calculate the probability of R given S from the probability of S given R, given a prior over R. And there's Bayesian conditioning, where if you learn the value of x, you update your degrees of belief about r to p of r given x. So these show up whenever you're doing a Bayesian inference problem. And you'll notice that they all require the notion of conditional probability. And that list of analogies I showed you didn't include an analog for the conditional probability. And so that's what we need to do. We need to have what Matt and I call a conditional state. to be the analog of conditional probability. So just as the joint probability was a function of two variables, so is a conditional probability. Consider it as a function of two variables. So we will also associate with it an operator on the tensor product of the Hilbert space of A and the Hilbert space of B. And I'll just denote it rho B given A to remind you what its role is supposed to be. We have a normalization condition, classically, that if you sum over the values of S, you'll get 1 for every possible value of R. Of course, the thing on the left-hand side is a function over R, so I should think of the thing on the right-hand side as a function over R. It's just the uniform function with value 1. And the analog of that is the identity operator on A. The analog of marginalization is a trace, so I demand that the trace over B of rho B given A is identity on A. That's sort of the natural
analog. Are
you going
to show explicitly rho B given A?
Yeah, I'm coming to it. So if you take this condition and the condition that this thing be positive, you get the proposal that Matt Leifer made in 2006 for what we should take to be a good quantum analog of conditional probability. Rafael?
Question on the general point of view. In the story you told us before, there was this uncontrolled disturbance.
Yes.
Is that hidden within the Bayesian update rule here, or where exactly?
So in that story about the measurement and the disturbance, that came out of the physics. You know, it was a fact of the physics that there's an action-reaction principle, which means that the probe cannot get information about the position of the system without the system having its momentum influenced by the probe. That's a fact of physics. That's not a fact about any theory of Bayesian inference. I could imagine a world wherein there is no action-reaction principle, and I could still apply classical probability theory to that world and ask, how should I update my knowledge in the light of new evidence? So I would say that aspect is not part of the theory of Bayesian inference, and therefore the quantum analog of the theory of Bayesian inference that we develop should not incorporate those sorts of things. We should be able to cleanly separate stuff that has to do with the physics with stuff that's purely Bayesian inference. And that's where I'm going. I'm going to try to convince you that we've done that.
So you don't, in that story, you needed it for consistency, but here you're saying you won't need it for consistency. Or are you saying if you model it, if you make a model, it'll be there when it's needed?
I don't know what you mean by we need it for consistency. The theory I told you about was a classical theory, so you know all the rules of classical mechanics apply, and then there's this restriction on knowledge, and we say what its consequences
right.
are. And in that kind of world, it's just a fact of life by virtue of dynamics being Hamiltonian, that there is no way of having a system learn about another system position without this back action. And then the epistemic restriction means that that back action introduces uncertainty into the system that you're trying to measure. So that is a consequence, I would say, of the physics. You're going to see later how that same scenario, EPR and collapse rule, arise in quantum theory, and how we get the same decomposition into Bayesian updating and disturbance. But you'll have to wait for that. Okay, so let's say a bit more about these objects. We know in the classical theory that I can define a conditional probability in terms of a joint. I just take the joint probability, divide by the marginal on R, and I get the conditional probability of S given R. So the analog in the quantum case, you'd like to divide by the marginal on A to get rho B given A, but you can't just multiply, say, on the right with rho A inverse, because then the thing you get wouldn't be positive anymore. So you just do this trick. You multiply on both sides by rho A to the minus a half tensor identity on B. That gives you an operator that's positive. If you trace over B, so trace over B on this side, pull it through, you just get rho A here, and then these guys combine to just give you identity on A. Of course, if rho A doesn't have support on the full Hilbert space, you only get the identity operator on the support of rho A. And the way you can deal with that problem is just say this thing, strictly speaking, is only defined on the support of rho A. But that's completely analogous to how in classical probability theory we say P of S given R is only defined for those values of R such that P of R is not equal to 0. Okay, so there's nothing new going on with that caveat. Okay, so I'm going to write that equation by dropping the tensor products and the identities, because I'm always going to have subscripts that tell you what Hilbert space these things act on. There will be no ambiguity in a formula like this. And then furthermore, I introduced this star product notation to just mean, act by the square root of this thing on either side of the one on the left. So this is a non-commutative, non-associative product, and its role here is to make equations look pretty, because this looks a lot more like that when I write it in this form. Okay, so if in classical probability theory, I solve for the joint probability in terms of the conditional, this is what I get. I can do the same thing over here. All I do is multiply this equation by rho a to the 1/2 on both sides. Rho a to the 1/2 on both sides of the equation. So I'll get that, which I can also write in terms of the star product, just as this, which is the analog of the classical formula. And then finally, the first pillar of Bayesian inference, which is belief propagation, has this form classically. The analog, the way you prove this is you just say, well, P of S is sum over R, P of S comma R, the joint. But this is an expression for the joint in terms of the conditional, so you just plug that in. Similarly here, rho B is the trace over A of rho AB, but we know that we can write rho AB in this form, so we just plug that in. And then the rho A to the 1/2, rho A to the 1/2, using the cyclic property of the trace, can be collected together in one spot. So it looks just like the classical expression. Yes?
So can you derive that definition for conditional then as a consequence of a set of axioms? Or?
I think you can. I think it is, but we haven't done it. So we had a few ideas for what might uniquely specify that definition. But none of them quite worked out. I should say that there are other definitions out there. So there was one by Surf and Adami, and Matt Leifer and David Poulain came up with a whole set of such definitions. And there may be scenarios wherein those are the appropriate things to use. The claim we make is that this particular definition seems to be the right one for measurement theory. So trying to figure out, how should I update my knowledge given the outcomes of measurements. I would like to be able to prove that it's the unique definition that does that, but I don't currently have a proof of that. Okay, so then the second pillar is Bayes' theorem. So let me just remind you the two-line proof of the classical Bayes' theorem. You have the joint can be written in terms of the conditional S given R times the probability of R, but it can also be decomposed into the probability of R given S times the probability of S. So you set those two things equal to one another, you solve for P of S given R in terms of P of R given S. That's it. And then because we have these expressions for the joint state in terms of the conditional state, and we can again have two such expressions, we can just set them equal to one another and solve for one in terms of the other, and now we have the quantum Bayes' theorem. So what it says is that if this is what describes your degrees of belief about A given B, then this is the object that should describe your degrees of belief about B given A. I can write that in terms of the star product, and it looks very simple. So now, in addition to those previous analogies we have, I've got all these other analogies. Definition of conditional state, the relation between joints and conditionals, Bayes' theorem, belief propagation. Good. Now is the sort of main point, the causal neutrality of this framework. So here's a fact about classical probability theory that doesn't often get mentioned explicitly, but I think it's quite interesting. If you have two systems, like the ones on the top, that are acausally related, then if you want to apply probability theory to them, you can write down a joint distribution, you can calculate the conditional by the standard formula, and you can propagate your beliefs about R to beliefs about S using the standard belief propagation formula. If, instead, you're interested in a pair of systems, R and S, which are causally related, so in particular, it could be that these are the same system, just considered at two different times. Suppose that's what you're interested in. Well, again, you can express your knowledge about that pair of systems by a joint probability. You can calculate the conditional probability of S given R. And if you want to propagate your beliefs about R to beliefs about S, you use exactly the same formula as you did over here. The formalism for Bayesian inference doesn't care what the relationship between the variables that you're applying it to are. Are they acausally related, causally related? Doesn't matter. It's the same formalism. Same formulas apply. So the question is, can we have a similar situation in the quantum case? We also have a notion of systems that are acausally related, systems that are causally related. How would we normally consider those situations? Well, normally we would just write down a joint state, rho AB, for this scenario, and we'd have nothing analogous to these guys. And over here, we would normally have this sort of equation. Rho B is given by applying some completely positive linear map to rho A. Could be unitary, could be irreversible. And that seems to be not analogous to anything over here. So our job is to try to fill in these blanks and see if we can get this symmetry between causal and acausal. So what I've told you so far, I should say, first of all, we can get a classical analog of this equation just by noting that I can think of this belief propagation as just the action of some map on the functions over R to the functions over S. All right, so I could just call it gamma R to S. And it will be a linear map because of its definition. It's defined this way. That thing is linear in these functions, so it's a linear map. So if I want, I could think of belief propagation in terms of these linear maps. We don't often do that in classical probability theory, but one can. And that would be the natural analog of this formula from quantum theory. But that means that we should have the ability to write our belief propagation in the acausal case in that way as well. So that just means that there's another sort of blank slot to fill in over here on the right. All right, so let me fill in these slots now. So what I've told you previously is that you can define a notion of a conditional state from a joint state in this scenario here, where you have two systems that are acausally related. This is the definition I wrote down. So that's the analog of the classical formula. That's the analog of belief propagation. And if I want, I can think of this belief propagation as just some map acting on the density operators on A, taking them to density operators on B. And so I've written this with a fractor font rather than a calligraphic font, because at this stage, it's not obvious that this thing has the same properties as this guy. It's not obvious that it's completely positive, for example. Similarly, I can work backwards over here. I can say, well, if I have a map from row A to row B, then I can always find a bipartite operator on A tensor B, which I'll call var row B given A, such that if I trace over A times this, this emulates this map here. You can prove that this is possible. And furthermore, if this map is trace preserving, then this operator here has the feature that if I trace over B of that operator, I have to get identity on A. That's the analog of the trace preserving property. So it looks a lot like one of these conditional states, except I haven't yet proven that this thing has to be positive. So I've denoted it by var rho rather than rho to admit that possibility. And then working backwards further, I can use that conditional state to define a joint state, rho AB. And so now I have an analog of the joint distribution. OK, so you might say, right, we're going to have the symmetry that we saw in the classical case if we can prove that you know, these maps have the same properties as these maps, and these states have the same properties as those states. But when you work it out, you find that's not true. You find that the conditional here was defined to be positive. But that means that the map that corresponds to this belief propagation is not completely positive, but rather, if I compose it with a partial trace on A, that map is completely positive. So this is just what's called the Jamolkowski isomorphism. There's a difference between the Jamolkowski isomorphism and the Choi isomorphism for the experts. This is the Jamolkowski isomorphism. So if you know it, you'll be familiar with this sort of property. And then down here, if your map is completely positive, then that implies that the operator that achieves that map is not itself positive, but its partial transpose on A is positive. Okay, so this asymmetry here is exactly the same as this asymmetry between the maps. And in fact, I can just drop the maps altogether and just talk about the conditionals, because they're equivalent ways of talking about belief propagation. So we have this asymmetry between the acausal and the causal scenario. And so this looks like bad news for our program. We wanted a causally neutral formulation of quantum theory that didn't see these sorts of differences. So what I want to convince you of is that actually this difference is not a difference in how you do Bayesian inference, and it arises in the classical context as well. Okay, so I'll start by telling you what the operational significance of this mathematical difference is by looking at some quantum experiments. What I want to do is compare some measurements you do on systems that are acausally related and systems that are causally related. So in particular, imagine you do a measurement of position on both these quantum systems, and then compare that with the case where you do a measurement of position on B and a preparation of position on A. Okay, so here I'm going to prepare an eigenstate of the position operator for A, and then evolve it, and then measure B. Okay, and the question is, what kinds of correlations can you get? Similarly, you can look at cases where you do momentum measurements in these four places and ask, what kinds of correlations do you get there? So here's what you find. If you look for those cases where you get perfect correlations, either positive or negative, you find that there are only certain states that will achieve perfect correlations. The EPR state is one of them. So the EPR state will give you perfect correlation for the position measurements and perfect anti-correlation for the momentum measurements. Meanwhile, over here, if you ask what kinds of channels between A and B, these are the analogs to the joint states on A and B, what kinds of channels give you perfect correlations? Well, the identity channel clearly does. It gives you perfect correlation for position and perfect correlation for momentum. Because if I prepare a position eigenstate, put it through the identity channel, measure position, I'll get the same outcome as what I prepared. Similarly for momentum. So you have a slight difference here in the pattern of correlations you have for that state and the pattern of correlations you have for that map. So you look for others. And for instance, if you define a unitary which inverts the sign of both position and momentum, you find that that is a valid unitary, and I can define a channel according to that unitary. And if I pass my systems to that channel, then I just find anti-correlation in position and anti-correlation in momentum. Meanwhile, if I act that unitary on half of an EPR state, then the kinds of correlations I get now are anti-correlations for position and correlations for momentum. But again, I still have this disanalogy. I don't have, here I have an odd number of correlations, here I always have an even number of correlations. And it turns out that these are all the states and channels that give you perfect correlations in this scenario. And so you have this asymmetry existing in quantum theory. There is no map that will show this pattern of correlations, and there is no state that will show this pattern of correlations. There's no state in quantum theory that will give you correlations for position and momentum measurements. So that's what that partial transpose difference ultimately meant. In our formalism, the reason you have to have it is because you have to explain this difference in the kinds of correlations you see across space and across time. Okay, so now let me show you that this same sort of thing arises in these classical theories I talked about early in the talk, these epistemically restricted legal mechanic type theories. So I have a pair of systems again, but now they have, you know, some state. It's a position in phase space. So I imagine measuring the position of both systems. And over here, I imagine preparing this guy in a well-defined position and then measuring his position later on. I can do that. Those are valid measurements. And similarly, I can do the same thing with momentum. So this is exactly the analogous experiment. And we have an analog of the EPR state, which is the state of knowledge wherein you know the difference between positions and the sum of the momenta. And that corresponds to seeing perfect correlations between the positions, perfect anti-correlations between the momenta. Similarly, there's an identity channel, which in this language is the conditional probability QB, PB given QA, PA, which just takes QB to be equal to QA and PB to be equal to PA. And there you see perfect correlations for both. So that's similar to what we saw in the quantum case. And we also have this other example where there's a dynamics which just changes the sign of position momentum. That gives us an anti-correlation for both. There's also a state that allows me to know the difference in momenta and the sum of the positions. Remember, this constraint came from variables only being jointly known if their Poisson bracket commutes. So QA plus QB and PA minus PB, their Poisson bracket commutes. I can jointly know them. Therefore, this is a distribution that's allowed. So we get the same sort of lack of analogy. And then if you say, well, what about some other possibilities? Like, could we have a dynamics that had this kind of pattern of correlations here? Could it be that QB is equal to QA and PB is minus PA? Well, there's certainly no Hamiltonian dynamics that does that, because Hamiltonian dynamics always preserves the Poisson bracket. And the Poisson bracket of QA and minus PA is the negative of the Poisson bracket of QB and PB. So this dynamics would not preserve the Poisson bracket. It's not a Hamiltonian dynamics. It's not allowed. Similarly, if I tried to measure the position and the momentum and then just re-prepare it as, you know, the position and the negative momentum, well, that's not allowed because in my because of my epistemic restriction. I can't measure both simultaneously. So you can prove that there's no way to do this in this theory. And so the list stopped here. There aren't more elements on this list. And similarly, if you look at the A causal case, if you said, could I have, you know, this kind of correlation over here on this side, well, that would correspond to knowing the difference in position and the difference in momentum. And those things don't have vanishing Poisson brackets, so they can't be jointly known. So you can't have those correlations. So you get precisely the same lack of symmetry between the acausal and the causal. And so one way to say it is that the kinds of, everything about Bayesian inference is exactly the same, right? You use these formulas to, for example, do belief propagation, but the set of conditional probabilities that you're allowed to apply by virtue of the physics is limited. You can't have any old conditional probability. So for example, you know, a conditional probability that would describe a non-Hamiltonian evolution is perfectly well defined. It just so happens that if the laws of physics are Hamiltonian dynamics, I never assign that conditional probability to the dynamics of a system. So I get a restricted set of conditional probabilities that will describe causally related systems. And I also get a restricted set that describe acausally related systems. And the connection between them is just given by a map which inverts the momentum of one of the systems. Otherwise, they're exactly the same set. And in the quantum case, it's you can think of it in exactly the same way. You could say, you know, what we've really got is a set of operators on tensor product Hilbert spaces, and they satisfy some general formulas of Bayesian inference. But in particular scenarios, like the causal scenario, the kinds of conditional states I can write down are limited because of the physics. And so there's some restricted set of conditional states that you write down. And there's also a restricted set of conditional states you write down in the acausal scenario. And the connection between these two guys is just that this set is the partial transpose over A of this set. And that's exactly the analog of this momentum inversion, because momentum inversion is time reversal. Partial transpose is the representation in quantum theory of time reversal. So it's exactly what you would expect. OK, so I'm going to take another 5 minutes or so tell you get back to the EPR steering and the collapse scenario from what we've learned, and then I'll stop. But I need a little bit of background before I can do that. So let me talk about how you model classical systems within this new framework for Bayesian inference. So it's very simple. If I have a probability distribution over x, well, I can just associate a Hilbert space with x, write down an operator rho x, which is diagonal with respect to some preferred basis on that Hilbert space. Right? That's my way of representing a classical probability distribution. If I have a set of states on Hilbert space A, labeled by some variable x, then I can represent that by a conditional state, rho A given x, of the following form. So on x, it's going to be diagonal for this same preferred basis. And over here on A, it's going to have just these quantum states. So you can see that this is a valid conditional state because, one, it's positive, right? This is positive, so the whole thing's positive. Two, if I trace over A, I should get identity on X. So if I trace over A, I get 1 here, I get a sum over X of X, that's identity on X. So the any conditional state, quantum given classical, the information it contains is precisely the information contained in a set of normalized states. Similarly, if you look at a POVM on system A, then that gets represented by a conditional state where it's classical given quantum. So the POVMs appear over here on system A. I again have my preferred basis for x here. And you can verify this is positive. If I trace over x, I should get identity on A. So I look, I trace over x, I get 1s here, I get sum over x, exa. Well, if that's a POVM, they sum to identity. So it does satisfy the definition of a conditional state. So this is sort of natural because you can think of these conditional states, you know, when you do belief propagation. This takes you from your beliefs about a classical system to your beliefs about a quantum system. That's what a set of states does. This takes you from beliefs about a quantum system to beliefs about a classical system. That's what a POVM does, quantum to classical. And similarly, if you have a measurement and you've got a quantum instrument, which is a set of CP maps labeled by the outcomes, you can represent that in this formalism as just a conditional state given the input and the outcome and the output are on the left of the conditional. In terms of this new way of writing things, a lot of familiar formulas in quantum theory end up just being examples of belief propagation. So here's a familiar formula. If you have a set of states and a prior over x, you can average those states to get the average state on A. Well, that's just, in this formalism, saying take your degrees of belief about x, propagate them to A by taking the conditional, rho A given x, that represents the set of states, trace over x, you get your degrees of belief about A. Similarly, the Born rule is a way of calculating probabilities for outcomes of a measurement from a POVM and an initial state. That just corresponds to propagating your beliefs about the input A to beliefs about the outcome of the measurement. And finally, a state update rule, where you apply some element of a quantum instrument to your input state and get some unnormalized states coming out. That's just going to, again, be belief propagation from A to Y, B. The final pillar of Bayesian inference, which I haven't told you about yet, is Bayesian conditioning. So that's the final ingredient I need. There's something in classical probability theory called Jeffrey conditioning, which is just saying that if you update your knowledge about R to some posterior, then you should update your knowledge about S to a posterior, which is just given by plugging your new knowledge about R into the same belief propagation formula. So you just use the same conditional S given R to propagate these beliefs about R to S. You can do exactly the same thing in this quantum theory. If you get new knowledge about A, then your new knowledge about B should be given by the belief propagation formula. Bayesian conditioning is a particular kind of this general sort of conditioning wherein your posterior about x is actually a point distribution. So you learn everything there is to know about x. It becomes a point distribution on some particular value. And if you plug that into this formula here, so this delta function, you find that your posterior for s should just be p of s given x taking the value that you know it to have. So that's Bayesian conditioning. And again, there's just a straightforward analog here. If the thing that you're conditioning on is a classical system, so if I'm looking at learning about some classical system x, then I can say that my posterior about x could be a projector onto some particular value. I plug that in, and I just get a particular term of rho b given x, which I'll call rho b given x equal to little x. And so Bayesian conditioning in the quantum case is just this math here. Okay, so given all those pillars of Bayesian inference, I can now reanalyze the two examples we saw in the beginning, the steering EPR steering scenario and the quantum collapse rule, entirely using this formalism to see what it says about what's going on in those scenarios. So I'm generalizing now from the case where you have an EPR state and a measurement of position momentum to a case where you have some arbitrary state, rho AB, and some arbitrary measurement corresponding to this POVM, which in our formalism is just a rho x given A. And suppose you learn that it has some value. So in that scenario, you should update your beliefs about B by just doing Bayesian conditioning. You say, what should I believe about B given that I learned that x has the value little x? That's what you should do. It's just exactly how you would do it in the classical probability theory. And then you use all the tools I've introduced to solve this problem. So you say, how do I calculate rho b given x? Well, I can use Bayesian inversion to express rho b given x in terms of rho x given b, using this formula. And then you can calculate rho x given b by saying, well, I can calculate rho a given b. That's just take the joint, multiply by rho b to the minus 1/2 on both sides. That gives you rho a b. And then propagate your beliefs about a to x. So I combine rho a given b with rho x given a. Rho x given a is just the measurement. Trace over A, so I've propagated my beliefs about A to X, I'm left with rho X given B. So I can plug that into this formula, and I can solve for rho B given X. And so it's just, you know, you turn the crank as you would in classical Bayesian inference. And if you rewrite the solution in sort of the conventional notation, E is our POVM, this is what you find. That under this sort of approach, rho B updates to root rho b, e root rho b, where e is some particular, it's take the measurement you were doing on A, propagate it through some particular channel corresponding to this state here, and that gives you a POVM on B. So this is what Bayesian conditioning looks like in this context. And it's a lot like classical Bayesian conditioning because these states always have support within the support of the initial state. So you're refining your knowledge. So if you have some rho b that was highly mixed, and this POVM is maybe a rank 1 POVM, then you'll be left with a posterior rho b given x that's much narrower. So you're always gaining information in these sorts of update rules. Okay, so the story is that for EPR collapse, the lesson that the epistemically restricted classical theory suggested that we should think of remote collapse as pure Bayesian conditioning, well, that still holds in this formalism. It's pure Bayesian conditioning, nothing else. That's what the formalism tells us. Even though we can't really say what it's knowledge about, we can say according to this formalism, that's all that's going on. But what about quantum collapse? If it were pure Bayesian conditioning, then we would expect that my knowledge about rho b, when I evolve it to knowledge about the final state, would go to something of this form, root rho b, e root rho b. That's what pure Bayesian conditioning looks like in this formalism. But that's not what happens. And let me show you why. So here's our direct measurement on the system. What's given is a POVM on B. We also have to describe how this measurement affects the system. So there's a set of maps. This is the quantum instrument that tells how B evolves to B prime given a particular outcome x. So that's given in the problem. And now the formalism just says, okay, if you want to know what your final state of knowledge about B prime should be, given that you've learned x, just update to this thing. Calculate this quantity here. So that's what we do. We calculate that quantity. And again, you just, you know, you turn the crank. What is rho B prime given x? Well, it can be written as the joint rho B prime and x. Starred with rho x inverse. Rho b prime and x, this joint, can be written as the belief propagation of your beliefs about b to beliefs about this pair using this conditional. So that's this here. And you can just solve for what that looks like back in the conventional notation. And this is what it is, just given in terms of the quantum instrument. And a particularly popular way of doing updates is called the Luders rule, and it has the square roots of the POVM elements on the outside. So it has a rho b in the middle and square roots of the POVM on the outside. And that's not the Bayesian conditioning. It had the root rho b's on the outside and the e on the inside. This is very different. If I sum these guys up over x, I don't necessarily get rho b back again. I might get something completely different. So the Clough rule is not Bayesian conditioning in this formalism. Why not? Well, we can do exactly the same thing. We can say, well, let's analyze the measurement a little bit more carefully in terms of coupling the system to a probe. And then we can characterize this interaction by some conditional, which really corresponds to some unitary of AB going to A prime B prime. There's physics in this. Just as in classical mechanics, Hamiltonian dynamics said, not all evolutions are possible. There's action-reaction. Similarly here, not all operators here are possible. There's a restricted set of operators that are possible to do use. In your inference. And in particular, what you can prove is that if A prime gets information about B in any unitary evolution, then B prime gets some information about A. It's also an action-reaction principle in the quantum case. Another way of saying that is that if the measurement is informative, right, so if this measurement over here tells me anything at all about B, then the channel from B to B prime cannot be purely identity. It can't be that B prime depends only on B and not on A. And this is how you would write that in the formalism. I won't go into details about that because I'm out of time. But because of that restriction that comes from the physics, what you find is that the collapse rule in this formalism breaks into two parts. There's a belief propagation part, your knowledge about B to your knowledge about B prime, that involves an unknown disturbance because of this back action. You couple to the probe, the state of the probe influences the system. So uncertainty, your uncertainty about the probe leaks into the system. And then you follow that up by a Bayesian conditioning, where you now make use of this information you've gained to get to rho b prime given x. And so it's exactly the way it was described at the beginning of the talk. Anyhow, there's a bunch of other applications of this sort of formalism, but I just wanted to focus on that causal neutrality for this talk. You can ask me about these later if you like, and let me just leave you with some references and stop there. Thanks for your attention.
We have time for some questions.
Just a general question. I was just going back to the slide you put up at the beginning.
Which one?
The quote from James about being some omelette.
Yes.
Really scrambled together in an omelette.
Yeah.
The task is to get back.
Yes, the omelette of ontology and epistemology, yes.
Yes. And I suppose, you know, you're saying the subjective side is the probability theory, and the objective side is the
physics.
Real object. Yes, the physics.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me you haven't really totally separated them, because there's this question of how the states evolve. So there are certain evolutions of states that are not possible. And that's a matter of physics.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the state is a matter of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not really deriving that, so far as I can see, just from physical considerations. I mean, that goes back to the von Neumann collapse thing. I mean, there's an extra postulate in there that it just so happens that you're restricted to certain states of knowledge and other
right.
states of knowledge are not
right.
possible.
Right.
And that's the way it is. And you can sort of, it's very nice, you can show that it's sort of consistent by considering the interaction between the probe and the system. But I can't see that you can really derive it. And so it's got a rather I'm thinking it's still kind of scrambled.
Or the classical.
I'm thinking of the picture you're presenting, and I guess you're trying to de-scramble.
Right, okay, so let's consider two de-scramblings. So there's the de-scrambling within what I call epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics,
yes.
which is this theory that reproduces some quantum mechanics but not all
yes.
quantum mechanics. We could imagine a universe that was governed by that
yeah.
theory. So I would say in that theory, I think I've de-scrambled the ontology and the epistemology because from my perspective, the epistemic restriction is part of the physics. Right? So, you know, by virtue of the way that systems in the universe are built, they cannot come to learn arbitrary amounts of knowledge about systems around them. We can understand that to some extent by looking at the von Neumann chain and seeing that if the resources we have constrained knowledge about them, then we can never escape that, you know, because of action reaction. All right, so I see that restriction on the kinds of conditional probabilities you can use as coming from the physics, but then once you've got the conditional probability, how you do belief propagation, that's just the normal way you do it within
sure.
Bayesian inference.
Sure.
So on that side of things, I would say we have a separation of the two concepts. And then on the quantum side of things, all I'm really saying is that, look, we've got this formalism for thinking about quantum theory now. And by analogy, we can say that, you know, the separation that seemed natural for epistemically restricted Liouville mechanics, we can imagine this, you know, drawing the same lines for quantum theory, and it all seems to fit nicely together. We could just say it looks as if this restriction on the forms of the conditional states must be a consequence of the physics. But the belief propagation formula in quantum theory, that's just Bayesian inference. So I haven't really derived that fact. I've more sort of stipulated it and said, by analogy with this other theory, which I can interpret easily, it seems to be that's how we should separate things. So that's my claim, is that I think this is a useful way of separating things. It's the way we ought to separate them.
Yeah, I was just thinking it still seems a bit the statement that only certain states of knowledge are possible,
yep.
it seems a bit ambiguous to me which side it's on. It's on the boundary.
So,
okay.
I mean, the comment. I mean, I think one can think about it like in this way. If you have these agents around with knowledge, well, let's try to put them in the formalism. Let's let them have physical state by themselves. So you're going to have a system and an agent. Both of those things are actually in the system. They would be phase-based points or something like that.
Now, I don't see anything wrong that the state of the system, as it is, it's one point in this big phase space or whatever, happens to be the case that an agent has perfect knowledge, which is just the brain state of this agent, right, has perfect knowledge of the system. What's I mean, if it wants to have, on the physical side, sort of a restrictions on an epistemic state, and at the same time think of epistemic states as actual physical brain states or something, then I think you have to sort of take out points in phase space and saying those points are forbidden, corresponding to the agent having perfect knowledge of the system. I mean, knowledge is a physical thing, right? I have it in my brain. It's a specific physical state, right? So this is sort of, do you see what I'm saying?
I mean, I agree that you can always choose to model, you know, any information acquiring system like a measurement device dynamically if you want, you know, assign it.
And what forbids it now to be perfectly correlated? I mean, just if you have a system, it's either one or zero, and then you have its brain state. It's suppose the system has several different parameters or something like that, and you just find a copy in his brain or something like that, and that's the way the universe began or something like that. I don't see how you can, if one starts saying that I should rule out certain types of knowledge, to me, you're saying I'm ruling out certain phase-based points. That's impossible. Because a phase-based, I mean, knowledge
yes.
is a phase-based
right.
point.
Right.
So,
how
is that done here or not? I don't think, I didn't get the idea that this is, you're ruling out certain states, right?
I mean, I wasn't phrasing the restriction in that way, but I think you're right that ultimately, you know, you'd have to say, you know, if I can imagine the universe starting out with some observer, you know, knowing everything about the phase-space point of some other system. I think I can imagine that. And that's, you know, forbidden according to this postulate. So you know, instead, we imagine observers that don't start out with that knowledge. And then we appeal to Hamiltonian dynamics to show that they can never overcome that limitation.
So it would be interesting to just see what this physical phase space is then, where it's impossible to, and then, of course, that will depend on how the agent were modeled also within the system, right? Suppose the brain could be in two different ways, and, I mean, you can, I don't know, it's probably a bit muddy problem, I think, to actually rule these things out. But this is sort of related to this question. I mean, how do you implement this physically, this epistemic restriction?
Let me say just a very general comment on that, which is, to some extent, I think, you know, here we're contemplating that the correct theory of Bayesian inference, which is a theory of how you ought to reason in the face of uncertainty, you know, might not be the classical theory of Bayesian inference. It might be this non-commutative generalization of that. So in some sense, we're already kind of granting that maybe a theory of inference is an empirical thing. And therefore, there's a sense in which I'm not really committed to an absolute divide between epistemology and ontology, you know, because ultimately it seems plausible that the physics of the world could well constrain, you know, what our best theory of inference is. You know, after all, we're physical systems. You know, we're trying to make inferences. We're trying to win gambles. Why shouldn't the physics of the world matter to how that happens?
I mean,
I'm okay with saying that yes, maybe the distinction ultimately breaks down, but I think, you know, insofar as we can make the distinction, it's, you know, useful often in applying it to make that distinction. And I think learning how to make that distinction in the quantum context can teach us a lot about how to move forward, even if it's not ultimately a fundamental distinction.
I was just going to say that. I mean, actually, quantum mechanics started off with experiments, Planck trying to explain black body radiation and so on, and we wouldn't be talking this way about restrictions on our knowledge if it wasn't for the experimental work done 100 years ago. So clearly, the physics has forced us to change our ideas about inference. It's some, in some sense, it's been derived for the empirical considerations, physical ones.
I would agree with that, except you sort of said the experiments forced us to realize that our knowledge is perhaps constrained, therefore we're doing inference differently. But I see those two as two different things. There's, you know, one, what kinds of conditional probabilities or conditional states should we use? That's the constraint of knowledge. How should we do inference? That's like a belief propagation algorithm. They're separate things. So I would say, yeah, experiments may have taught us that we need to use this non-commutative generalization of belief propagation formula to actually make inferences. But that's separate from, you know, having taught us that there's a constraint on the kinds of things we know. It's done both those things, yeah.
So the epistemic constraint that you had is sort of not causally neutral in the sense that it sort of makes time, it's a common special footing, like versus space. So I think it's stated at a given moment in time. Is that right? I think that must be the origin of how can you get this asymmetry in the classical case for the restricted cases.
Right.
The space yes. like one is different from the timeline one because the epistemic restriction itself is
right.
not causally neutral. It has a causal preference built into it.
I think that's
so.
That's
is there some similar statement in the quantum case that would gain insight for the quantum case from the observation?
Can you repeat the question? Maybe sorry.
So the point Policeman is making that the asymmetry between causally related and acausally related systems of space and time, which are a particular example of that, was sort of built into the epistemically restricted theory by the nature of the epistemic restriction. It said, you know, you can't know variables that whose Poisson brackets don't vanish simultaneously, and there was no such restriction, you know, across time. So it was sort of captured there in the restriction. And the question is, what does that teach us about quantum theory? I don't really know. I guess I would say, maybe one point to me is I don't think the restriction is particularly ad hoc. I think it sort of fits nicely with the rest of classical physics. You know, the whole idea of constraining your knowledge using the Poisson bracket, I think, is a very natural idea, and you know, the von Neumann chain type stuff shows that it all fits together well. So I think there's something sort of natural in the classical theory about that kind of restriction, and I suspect that, you know, whatever it is, it's embodied in quantum theory already. You know, there in the kinds of conditional states we can have causally and acausally.
But it's not a causally neutral kind of restriction.
That's right. One way to think about it is, so I haven't talked at all about it today, but you know, Matt and I have been thinking a lot about this approach in the machine learning community to inferring causal structure from correlations, and you can use this quantum theory of Bayesian inference to try to infer causal structure based on quantum correlations. And I think what's coming out here is that distinction between causal and acausal, that has something to say about causality. It's not part of the epistemology. It's not part of how you do inference. It's part of how things are causally connected to one another. And so, my guess is that, you know, how could you possibly do justice to Bell's theorem with quantum states being a state of knowledge? Well, perhaps it's our notions of causation that have to be updated from the classical notions to something else. And so now this distinction between causal and acausal states is sort of a clue for what that causal structure has to look like. But I'm not sure I can say anything more about it. Do you think there's something?
No, I mean, what you're saying sounds very similar to the sort of ideas that Raphael has played with to find new notions of causality in the quantum case.
Yeah.
So I have no idea.